David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us with a wrap-up of some of the latest stories. Hi, David. What's new?
Hey, Rob. I've got three C's for you today. Corn, color, and champions.
You're being mysterious, Dave. So which one do you want to talk about first?
Champions is the most mysterious. And actually, when I say champions, I mean we are the champions. And that's a reference to that classic Queen song, which, as many people would agree, is quite a happy song.
Makes me feel good.
Makes me feel good, too. And the question with this study is, you know, just because you and I think it's a happy song, would somebody, say, in a remote village in Africa also find it a happy song?
Somebody who's never listened to Western music.
Exactly. And the reason we care about that is because biologists have been arguing over whether music serves any sort of evolutionary importance. You know, some people have postulated that, you know, music has a function for group communication or group solidarity. But a famous linguist, Steven Pinker, said that music's just auditory cheesecake.
Cheesecake? What's he mean by that?
It just means that, you know, it's just, it doesn't have any evolutionary importance. We just do it because we like it. And so one clue as to whether your music would have some sort of evolutionary importance would be if everybody around the world, regardless of background or location, could agree on, say, what's a happy piece of music and what's a sad piece of music, because that might suggest that there's something ingrained in our sort of collective psyche about the meaning of music.
So these researchers went to Africa and played Queen, We Are the Champions?
Well, they didn't play Queen. They played this song instead.
That sounds pretty happy.
And it sounds happy to me, too. And the question was, would people in this remote village in Cameroon called the Mafa people also think it was happy? And these people, what's important about these people is they've never been exposed to Western music. They don't have electricity. They don't go to churches where sometimes Western music is played. They're not hearing ringtones on cell phones, things like that.
Did they think it was happy?
They did. In fact, well, they were given the choice. They were played not just that sample, but the Mafa people were also played music that we would consider sad or scary. And the researchers asked them, does this music sound happy to you? Does it sound scary? Does it sound sad? And about 60% of the time, they were able to pick out the happy music, which is much better than chance, which would be about 30%. And with the sad and the fearful music, their hit rate was about 50%. So still much better than chance.
Because three types of music would suggest 33% of the time they would get it if they were just guessing.
Exactly. And just as a control, the researchers played this music for a group of 20 Germans. And the Germans got the happy music right 100% of the time. And they got the sad and fearful music right about 80% of the time.
So what are they concluding from this 60% or 50% that music is, as Steven Pinker said, auditory cheesecake with no real evolutionary significance or not?
No, it actually appears that music is not auditory cheesecake. In fact, because these very different people can recognize similar themes in the same piece of music, it suggests that there may be something ingrained about our response to music, which suggests that it does have some sort of evolutionary importance.
So what's next, color or corn?
Well, let's do color. And this next study has to do with birds with different colored heads. And specifically, these birds are Gouldian finches. And they come in two head color varieties. They either have a red head or a black head. And, you know, females can have either head color and so can males. And what researchers have noticed in the wild is that when birds of the same color mate, the female tends to have an even ratio of offspring. In other words, she has as many males as she has females. But when two different color-headed birds get together, this ratio is really skewed. There's a lot more males, sometimes as high as 70 to 80% males to females.
Just in this species?
That's just in this species.
Do researchers think there's some sort of evolutionary advantage to having the more male birds than the female birds when the head colors don't match?
Well, the idea is that if the head colors don't match, that the genes of the two birds may not be very well compatible. And in fact, researchers have shown that when these different colored birds mate, a lot more of the daughters die. And they think it's because of genetic incompatibility. So the theory goes that if a female says, hey, I've got a mate with this male who's got a different head color, and I know a lot of my daughters are going to die because we're genetically incompatible, I'm going to somehow choose to have more sons. That way I'm not investing a lot of energy in a bunch of daughters that aren't going to live to maturity.
How does that happen?
Well, so that's the big question. And first of all, are females even making this sort of conscious decision? Or is this ability to have more sons than daughters, something that's really happening on a genetic level, and the female really has no control. So to find out, the researchers actually did a pretty cool experiment. What they did was they got out their paintbrushes.
Oh, no.
And they took a bunch of males, and they took males that had black heads and colored their heads red and vice versa, and then they mated them with the females. So this time, the genetics didn't play into it at all. It was all what the female saw. And what was really surprising was that this color made a much bigger difference than genetics. If the female thought she was mating with a male that had the same head color, even though if he wasn't
a real redhead.
Even if he say wasn't a real redhead, she had an even number of sons and daughters, just as if this male was really the same color as she was. But when they painted the male the opposite color, all of a sudden she had a lot more sons. She had, on average, she had about 70% sons versus 50% sons.
Did the daughters still die?
The daughters still die. So you can't really fool Mother Nature. You're really just fooling the female. But what it shows is that the female is making this decision to have more sons and daughters consciously. She's saying, hey, this male has a different color than me or has the same color than me. I'm going to have more sons, or I'm going to have, you know, an even number of sons and daughters.
So it's conscious. How does it work?
Well, that's still an unresolved question. They think they know the why now, but they're still trying to figure out the how.
Okay, last one, corn.
Rob, what do you like about corn?
Dave, I only like the corn when it's sweet.
Well, I like sweet corn too, but I think we can all agree that the great thing about corn is it's got these succulent kernels, these juicy kernels, and it's just great to eat, you know, either on the cob or, you know, even in a can. But corn wasn't always this way. In fact, the ancestor of corn, which is a plant known as teosinte, which originated in Mexico, is nothing like the corn as we know it today. First of all, the cobs on this plant are not filled with a bunch of juicy yellow kernels. They have maybe 5 or 10 or 15 rock-hard kernels. Definitely not a lot of fun to eat. So the question is, when did human beings domesticate this teosinte and turn it into the corn we eat today? And that's important because, you know, when researchers are thinking about, you know, the rise of agriculture and hence the rise of civilization, it's all pegged to this idea of when did we start farming? When did we start domesticating? So, you know, there's bigger implications here than just, you know, getting tasty corn in our plate. But it's hard to answer these questions. In fact, researchers have debated for decades about just when corn was domesticated. But they hit a breakthrough in 2002.
Some new evidence.
And this was genetic evidence. And basically what happened was a team genetically compared a specific type of teosinte, which was in the Balsas River region of Mexico, sort of suspecting that may be the region around where corn was domesticated. And they compared that to the genome of today's modern corn. And what they found via, you know, some genetic detective work was they were able to trace back genetically that corn must have been domesticated, you know, about 9,000 years ago. And until then, archaeological evidence had suggested corn was domesticated as late as 6,000 years ago, but nobody had found any evidence that it was domesticated any earlier than that. So the trick for researchers was to see, you know, can we find some archaeological evidence that supports this genetic hypothesis?
And that's this study.
Okay.
What did they find?
Well, some researchers went digging around the Balsa River area, and they found this giant boulder, and they dug under the boulder, and what they found was a treasure trove of prehistoric grinding stones. And these were the stones that, you know, ancient peoples used to, you know, grind grains and what have you. And what they found on these stones were something called phytoliths. And what phytoliths are, they're just sort of these like microscopic plant fossils. And they also found some starch grains on these grinding stones. And they did some radiocarbon dating. And sure enough, these fossilized grains were 8,700 years old. So that squared really nicely with this genetic evidence that suggested that corn was domesticated about 9,000 years ago, you know, in this Balsas River area and spread out from there.
There was only one domestication event then.
That's what the researchers say.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what else are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, on the research side of things, we're looking into a story about a potential new technology that would allow people to power their iPods while walking. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're doing a story about how President Obama may not be as green or as environmentally friendly as he says he is, and also what the stimulus package means for autism research. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find links to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.